Southwood Drive in Eden, North Carolina, 27288. My telephone number is 910-623-7787. And I'm interviewing Dr. Charles Sugg, who is in the Air Force. And Charlie, would you identify yourself with...
Okay, I'm Charlie Sugg. I'm born in 1919, October the 17th, in Fuquay Springs. And that is a different address from where I'm living now. My current address, the phone number is 910-627-7410.
Your address?
My address at the time of service, it says. Yeah. I was in Fuquay Varina, North Carolina. And we didn't have a zip then. And branch of service, I was in the Air Force. Went through the cadets and graduated in, I guess, 1943,
it was. And
my current address is 408 Greenway Drive in Eden, North Carolina, 27288.
And what was your address at the time you entered the service, Charlie?
Fuquay, Varina, North Carolina.
Okay. And the branch of service was the Air Force, and why did you choose the Air Force?
Well, I guess if I had to tell the truth, it was because I would delay active service until after I finished my training. I guess that would probably be the real reason, but I thought the Air Force was probably the branch that I would be most interested in, would enjoy the most.
Okay, and you went into the Air Force what year then?
January the 1st, 43.
And what were you doing before you entered the service?
I was in college.
College, you know, Wake Forest?
Wake Forest.
Yeah, Wake Forest College. And at what age were you when you went in the Air Force then?
I was something like 22,
3. What was the process of getting into the Air Force? What steps did you have to take to get into the Air Force? What did you do?
Took the test and the IQ and things like that, you know, and just...
And where did you do that, in Fuquay?
I did that in Raleigh.
In Raleigh, okay. When you went into the Air Force, then what was your first assignment? Where did you go first?
Went to Miami Beach.
Ah, tough duty. And kind of describe the process of your training and up to the time you were commissioned then.
While we were down there, it was really a conditioning program. You get physically fit. I think the biggest thing they did was take us out and see how hard they could beat us up and how tough they could make us. So that one of the fellas said, if you can't fly the airplane, you carry it. And that's about the way we felt about it when we got through with the boot camp.
Now, this was in Miami?
That was in Miami.
Right, okay. And then you completed boot camp and then?
We went to college training detachment in Decatur, Illinois. And I was up there for about a month. And then they transferred me to Santa Ana, California, where I continued with my basic training, I guess, or with my Air Force training. And from there, we went to primary and Tucson, Arizona. Basic, I went to Basic in Bakersfield, California. Went to Advance in Douglas, Arizona. And then after, that's where I graduated. Was commissioned there, and from there I went to Hobbs, New Mexico to transition in B-17s.
What kind of aircraft did you fly when you went through these, at these various, you went to the basic?
Well, when I went to primary, I flew Ryans. And went to basic, I flew the BT-13. In advance, I flew the UC-78s and 18-9s.
And at that point, then you went into multi-engine?
From there, I went to multi-engine. Uh-huh. Oh, this was multi-engine. The UC-78s and the 89s were twin-engine.
Oh, okay. Twin-engine. Yeah. Okay. And your B-17 training was where, then?
In Hobbs, New Mexico.
Okay.
And it was there that my flying partner was Colonel Frank Armstrong, who had already, as I found out later, had already completed his tour at the same base that I was later assigned to when I went to combat. And he, after I got out and got through, he got to be general of the 8th Air Force in Alaska. And we had a real good relationship. I enjoyed him. Every time we'd go on RON somewhere, it was nice. You call the field, you know, and ask for landing instructions, and they'd give it to you and say, what's the highest rank you got on board? And we'd tell them full colonel. We were always met with a command car. I didn't have to ride the trucks like the others after I got to him for pardon, but it was a lot of fun.
How long was that training in B-17 before you qualified for, you know, actual duty then?
Really,
overseas?
I think that might have been 3 or 4 months.
So,
and then I went from there to Sioux City, Iowa, where I piddled around up there with the engineering group. And one of the boys couldn't pass his instrument check, and they gave me his crew that was already trained. Hmm. And so I didn't fly with them much before we went over there. But I think he had an exceptional crew. Because I think every member of my crew checked out as a lead in the position that he was flying. Hmm. So,
any particular incidents you remember, Charlie, through this period you're talking about that would be of interest that you might recall, either humorous or serious or whatever?
Well, we're not giving any names, are we?
No, not us. No.
So. My co-pilot got the 104th when we were in Lincoln, Nebraska. He had a little too much to drink, and the MP picked him up. As a result of that, he got a 104th Article of War, and we were detained for 6 weeks.
Because of him.
Waiting for the 104th to come through. And that gave me a lot of time to sit there and wait and get ready and stay alerted. But none of us could go until we all went. See, that was it. And we flew over there from Lincoln, Nebraska. We had the plane already loaded, equipped, and everything when we left there.
After 6 weeks delay.
After the delay we took.
Now, did your co-pilot remain with your crew then?
Stayed with us.
Stayed with the crew.
I think he lost some of his pay, I think, maybe. Mm-hmm. But they didn't treat him real rough.
How do you feel about the training you got on flying the B-17 and so forth? Do you feel like you were well prepared, with hindsight, for what you were going to face later? Do you feel like you were pretty well prepared?
I don't think the preparations as far as being qualified to manage this kind of equipment and operate it, you know, to the best that it could have been done. But they had us to the point that we could do it, and they had us mentally conditioned for the combat situation.
Did they put you through a lot of emergency type training? You know, lose an engine or lose two engines, whatever, and still handle a plane?
Oh, yeah, yeah. This was all in that. And since you mentioned lost an engine, I lost my drag strut on takeoff one time, and just left the left gear just swinging in the air, and they sent me from there over to Oklahoma City, Tinkerville, to crash land it, and I brought it in on one gear, and it rocked back on the other one. And didn't do $700 worth of damage to the supercharger.
It's amazing. So the gear held up?
They held it up, but when we came in, they had fire trucks and wrecking crews and ambulance services, news media, and everything scattered up and down the side of the runway. And when it came in and landed, man pulled up beside me in a Jeep. He was already racing, you know, to stay up with him as close as he could. And just as soon as it stopped, he put a jack under the wingtip and never got a wingtip.
It was
great.
So when you completed that training then, did you have any option about where you were going to go, or were you just follow orders or what?
Just following orders.
And
wherever they sent you.
And you flew from that, where was it, Omaha? Where was it again?
From Oklahoma.
Oklahoma City, yeah. You flew from Oklahoma City to England then, or?
Oh, no. I went from there to
I know you had
Sioux City, Iowa, and from Sioux City back to Lincoln, Nebraska, and that's where we got our training for combat at the in Lincoln.
Okay.
Yeah, to tell you what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to do it and that sort of thing. It was well done, but at the same time, the way they did it, it was interesting because they tried to make us think we knew everything and that we were qualified to do anything. You know, that's
self-confidence.
That's part of the training.
Oh, absolutely.
Part of training, they decided to do it. And we did. We thought we could handle the situation pretty good.
Anything else you can think of in your training and so forth that you want to mention there? You think you want to go on from there then?
Oh, well, everybody had the ups and downs. And on the way over there,
this is flying over.
I had trouble with my heating system. And tried to land in Greenland and couldn't get in there. Had to come down to Iceland. And we stopped there and spent the night and a day. Gassed up, got things fixed up the best we could. And went out there to take off right down on the waterfront. Wind was blowing like mad. And we took the plane off with the controls locked and got away with it. Took it off with trim tabs, then found out what was wrong.
No, that's a mistake, right?
That's a mistake. This is the reason I said we really weren't qualified to do the job as well as they thought that they had trained us maybe to do.
Yeah. But or were you young kids?
It takes a little experience.
Sure, you were young kids, really, basically. Okay, so then you were on your way over to England. Were you several aircraft with you at this time? Or
by myself, and when I left Iceland, I came down to Ireland, and I was supposed to turn at Ireland and go somewhere over in Scotland. I forgot, Stowe, I believe, was the name of the base. But anyway, we went to base off over there. But I got on the beam when I got up at in Scotland, northern Scotland. And it happened to be a submarine, German submarine. And when I went over the coast of Ireland, the southern coast of Ireland, I knew that I was too far. And I started listening to my navigator then. And he turned me around 165 degrees, and we went back where we were supposed to go.
Now, why didn't you listen to your navigator in the first place, Charlie?
I never had a navigator, never needed one.
And you didn't believe him.
And that's right. And of course, I was on the beam. I knew where I was. The only thing is, I was on the wrong one, and they were sending the right signal on the beam. But it was getting pretty narrow. I was getting pretty close down there to where the submarine was. It couldn't have been too far. But we turned around and never had any trouble.
Now, what base were you actually headed toward to land at this point? Do you recall?
Wherever the port of entry was in England. It seemed to me like it was at Stowe. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Can't remember. But anyway, it was a general port of entry.
Yeah. Port of entry. That's where planes came in. Mm-hmm. All the planes were overseas. Okay, so you got to England then and landed, and then what unit were you assigned to? What was your rank at that time, by the way? Were you
I was a second lieutenant, and I got to be a first lieutenant while I was over there, and that's all I got.
Yeah. Okay, so you landed at Stowe, and then where did you go from there then?
I went to...
Or did you know where you were going?
I didn't know where I was going, but I think I got on some mixed up orders because my friend was supposed to go to Polbrook because he had already completed a tour there, and he signed up for Polbrook, and when they got through, they sent him over to the 100th Air Force, and that was a suicide group.
Why is that?
Because they supposedly shot down some German planes after they had already surrendered. They were bringing them in for a landing.
Oh.
And had a fighter on both wings, and they opened fire on them, shot them down. He took off and went home and got home. But from then on, the Germans were after the 100th Air Force.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
And my friend, who later was my roommate, was sent over to the 100th, and he just packed his bag. The only reason he went back for a second tour is because they told him he could go back to Polbrook. And when he didn't get in the right place, he just packed his bag and hitchhiked over to Polbrook and told our colonel, who was then a pilot when he was at the first tour, and told him to get him to have some orders, that he wasn't staying at the 100th.
And he wasn't staying because he was?
Because he was misled. He got the wrong orders. And I was the only one that got the orders to the to Polbrook. And, of course, I was already established when he came in.
Now, what unit were you attached to then at that point?
351st Bomb Group.
351st Bomb Group. And that was part of the 8th Air Force?
That was 8th Air Force.
And who was the commanding general at that time?
General Lacy.
Okay. And
and he was on the base.
And Doolittle took over after a while, didn't he? Wasn't Doolittle at one point?
No, not on that whole thing. I've forgotten who the one was that came. We had one that came in from some base in Tennessee that general that took Lacy's place.
Uh-huh.
But he soon got to the point that he did things like Lacy did it, and Lacy said he never had any trouble as it, never had any disease or problems with anything, and he liked the way that it was being run. The only thing that bothered him was, and he said he hoped he could get that changed, was when he had to walk the boardwalks out there. We had mud in the yard all the time, had to walk the boardwalk.
Mm-hmm.
He said, for these young fellas to walk me off the boardwalk into the mud, he said, I don't think you ought to treat a general that way.
I agree. So what base did you actually, were you actually ultimately assigned to then?
I was assigned to Polbrook.
Polbrook, okay.
Polbrook.
Okay.
That's the 351st Bomb Group.
Yeah. Okay. So you were in Polbrook then. And what time frame is this now? This is
1944, December 44 to I guess April, May, I guess, 45.
What was your opinion of the B-17?
It was almost the best plane that was made. I'd say the only one that was more airworthy was probably the C-47. Ours would fly on one engine.
No kidding.
Yeah. We could
lose altitude.
We could maintain altitude on one engine.
No kidding.
Unloaded. We could fly it on two engines. Actually, we could climb a little bit.
Even if they were both on the same side? That made a little
difference. I don't know whether we could hold altitude with both of them on the same side or not, but we'd come pretty close. In other words, it beat the heck out of gliding.
And what was your bomb load on the B-17? How many bombs did you put aboard the...
Well, the 1,000-pounders, we take 6,000-pounders.
Mm-hmm. And is that what you usually had aboard?
No, we dropped everything from little fragmentary bombs to delay actions and hundreds and, you know, just anything that they put in. Actually, that's the reason I said I didn't have much to do with the fighting at all, because when I went to the plane every morning, my plane was already loaded.
There you go. Following instructions.
They follow instructions. They tell you what you had and what needed to be done.
Okay, getting away a little bit from the day-to-day activities, I'll talk about some other things here. When you were in the, and they want us to ask these questions, when you were stateside, what type of uniform did you wear? What were you wearing?
We were just below the buck privates. We had cadet uniforms.
Now that included a blouse, they call it,
No, we didn't have a blouse. Don't think. But we had caps. I was down in the hot climate all the time.
Yeah, I was wondering what they made you wear down there, if they made you wear that hot coat, you know.
Yeah. And we had those props on the cap, you know.
You have long sleeve shirts, short sleeve shirts? What did you wear?
Long sleeve shirts. And ties.
And ties, okay.
And it tucked in.
Yes.
And it tucked in.
Now, overseas, what did you wear? Day to day, you know.
Day to day on
when you weren't on the
base,
plane.
Flight suits.
And that's the most comfortable thing you can wear, I guess.
And you carry everything in your pockets. Maybe.
Did the supply system work well as somebody who needed, you know, various supplies for your plane? Of course, you say it was all done for you, I guess. But did you find that the supply system worked well for things that you needed to do your job?
Or the ordnance and maintenance?
Whatever.
Everything, yeah. We had in the 8th Air Force, we'd get anything we wanted. The 9th Air Force, they had to account for theirs.
Why is that?
I don't know, but I'll tell you what happened there while on this. I got shot down over in Liège one time. And while we were over there, two of my boys found a pair of flight boots over there that were sheep lined flight boots. And when we got ready to leave, we found some stuff out in the country that where a B-17 had been shot down, and we got the parts and fixed our plane up, so we go somewhere down in southern France to pick up some, get some gasoline so we could get back home. We didn't have enough, because we got lost it over there, so.
Because you were in friendly territory at this time.
Well, we were 12 miles from the front line there.
Okay, all right.
And, so we just went on down there and got our gas and things that were necessary and came on home. We got home in about 10 days. My squadron commander gets a letter that we had stolen some boots from the 9th Air Force over there. And he got a bill for $27. For the boots, that's what the 9th Air Force said was worth.
How'd they even know it?
I didn't even know it. I didn't know that they had picked him up. They were slipping in off over there, and they were moving in. What they were doing, they were going to move their base over there as soon as they could, because they had just moved the Germans out. The Germans had just moved out. And so we went off over there and went and got the got back over there and got the bill for the thing. I asked the boys, I said, none of you fellas stole any equipment while you were there, did you? No, sir, I said, we didn't get anything. And I told the squadron commander, who was Jimmy Stewart, this other squadron commander, nice fella. And I told him, I said, well, they said they didn't do it, but if we're charged with it, I said, I'll just pay it myself. He said, no, you're not. He says, I'm going to pay it. And I'm going to pay it with a check. And he says, whoever cashes that check is in trouble. So I never found out whether he had the check cashed or not.
That's amazing. Okay, another little kind of a housekeeping question. Your day-to-day activities, you had three meals a day, I assume, or you ate three meals a day.
Yeah.
What were they like? What kind of food did you get, and did you like it? And did you get sick and tired of it, or tell me about it?
Well, food was good. It was adequate. You can't eat at the Waldorf and be in a barn, you know. You got the sort of adjust to what you have, and we ate a lot of mutton. We ate a lot of powdered eggs, and of course, on mission days, you'd get fresh eggs before you'd go.
Time was that in the morning?
Usually thinking about 3 o'clock, 2:33, you know.
What were the rules about what time you had to hit the sack? Were there any rules?
No rules. You just had to be there for the next day.
I mean, you can stay up all night if you want to.
That's right, but you're the one that had to pay it.
Yeah, you pay the price.
Suffer through the next day. Of course.
Typically,
you could stay drunk all night, and they come in and they put you on 100% oxygen, saying you're in pretty fair shape. You know, they put you
Did
on.
Did that oxygen. Happen?
Oh, Lord, yeah, they drink like fish,
No rules that they tried to enforce?
As far as I know, they didn't.
No kidding. So typically, when you had an early morning mission, what time did you usually hit the sack? You had to get up at 3 o'clock or 2:30?
As a general thing, we'd be in there by 9:30, 10 o'clock.
So you get 5 hours sleep, yeah, or whatever, 4.5 hours, yeah, sleep.
But then you pay for it the next day because you don't get any time off. Everybody looked after themselves pretty well.
Yeah, right. Did you have any emergency rations aboard your plane?
Oh, yeah.
What did you have aboard the plane?
C rations, K rations? Yeah, I expect we had K rations. Mm-hmm. You know, that you could have for, I imagine, we had maybe a 10-day supply. I don't know. We had a lot of stuff. We even had first aid kits. And we carried guns. And
you had a sidearm, I
think. Sidearm, yeah.
45, I think.
That you couldn't be in a closed room and hit the wall.
That's right. I fired them a lot. How about your... you have an evaluation of the people that you reported to, who are the, you know, leaders, your squadron commanders, and what have you. Have any particular opinion of the quality of people that you were working with?
I tell you what, I think every one of them that I had anything to do with had to have been the nicest people we had, except one instructor that I had when I was in basic. He was a sort of a smart aleck, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't think he liked me, and probably I created a lot of the problems, you know, maybe.
Were most of the squadron commanders of the upper echelon in the officer corps, were they academy people, or many of them civilians who went to the CS or whatever?
Most of them were Army of the United States, you know. It wasn't U.S. Army. It was, now, Frank Armstrong was a West Point man.
Yeah.
He was the man I flew with.
Yeah.
When I was in, and he was a 1932 graduate, too. He'd been out for a while.
But most of the other people that you dealt with as your leaders, were they academy people, or were
no, none of them.
OCS types. Could you tell any difference between the two? You know, the academy versus the OCS, way they treated their people and the way they held themselves and what happened.
Well, they conducted themselves in a little different light. Because of the way they were trained, it's just like home training. You know, if everybody brought up in your home, they'd probably behave pretty much like you do. If they were brought up in a different atmosphere, it makes a difference in later life. And yeah. So I expect these people had been trained pretty well. And I didn't, I guess he's Armstrong and his classmate at West Point came by to see him one time, one of his classmates, and he was a brigadier general. And he came in the mess hall where we were eating. And so help me, Armstrong stood at attention the entire time he visited him, man.
Is that right?
No, he never put him at ease.
Frank Armstrong was a colonel at the time?
He was full colonel.
And his friend was a brigadier general, and Frank Armstrong stood at attention the whole time?
In the mess hall.
And his friend never put him at ease?
Never put him
at ease. Well, what kind of friend is that? I mean, could you figure that one out?
West Point.
Yeah.
You don't honor him, you're not respecting him, you're respecting the uniform.
Oh, I understand that, but why didn't the brigadier
I don't know about that.
I can understand Armstrong doing it until he was put at ease, but why wouldn't he put it at ease?
That's right.
That's my question.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like a good way to do things, but anyway, that's the way it was, anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have any, do you have any specific officers you can think of that you had an unusual degree of respect for, or anything that, you know, the way they treated the men of their own degree of heroism or whatever it might be? Anybody in particular that sticks out in your mind?
No.
Besides Frank Armstrong?
We had some that did some crazy things.
Okay.
We had one man to fly back across the channel with a plane on fire, because he thought he was going to get a medal, and I don't know whether they court-martialed him or whether they gave him a medal. I never found out. But,
as the plane was on fire, what should he have done?
Should have landed. He was in friendly territory at this time.
Oh, he should have just landed.
Oh, well, that's right. Yeah.
Oh, okay. But he flew back across the channel. And his idea was what?
Everybody said that thought that he was thought he'd get a medal for it.
Bringing his plane back, as opposed to landing it at the earliest possible moment.
That's one reason I said I think that a lot of the medals came as a result of things like cut it off. One, I don't know what this should tell us, I guess. we had to have what do you do when you assemble in the mornings? We were assembling. We couldn't assemble over King's Cliff where we used to assemble all the time, so we had to go across the channel and went to Paris. And it was one of our maximum effort runs. I don't have any idea how many planes we must have had there, but we had them about every 1,000 feet from, I'd say, 3,000 or 4,000 feet all the way up to 30,000 feet, you know, just trying to assemble in one place. In the clouds and in the fog and all kinds of flares, you know, we used to assemble with, you fire your flares and you know which place you were supposed to go to assemble. And, you know, which group you were supposed to tag on to. So, we got up there and planes were flying everywhere. If it had a few enemy planes there, they could shut down the whole Air Force.
How'd you keep from colliding? I mean, this is a major problem, I would guess.
Well, we all circled the same direction.
Yeah.
And basically, when you assemble, it's simple. You get about 500 feet above. Whoever's flying lead flies a pattern. Mm-hmm. And when you come in, you know what position before you leave there, what position you're supposed to be flying. Mm-hmm. And what you do is you come in about 500 feet above, wait until the other fellows get in that are going to take their position as they come. And then when it gets around to your turn, put your nose down and you build up your speed in a hurry and pull right into position, cut your power and you're in position. Whereas if you tried to come in underneath it and gain enough speed to get up, you never would make it, see?
Yeah.
So we assembled about 1,000 feet apart and then we'd drop into position. It was, like I said, we were pretty well trained to do what we had to do, but to say that we were qualified to be first-class airmen, I don't think so.
Charlie, how was the discipline in the group? Did you have any trouble with having to discipline the people that reported to you or any of the officers or whatever?
Never any trouble. Like I said, our general had to have been one of the nicest people in the world. And discipline wasn't a problem unless you abused it. You know, just to say that because I got a little rank over you, I'm going to take advantage of you. No, that wasn't, you couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But if it had to do with whatever your duties were, you're supposed to do that first. That's the first thing. And then after that, you do what you want to. That's basically what way he felt about it. And it was a good way to run a railroad. this.
You said there was a good bit of, I guess, drinking that went on.
Oh, yeah. All they could get.
What did you have? A bar on the base? What was there?
We had a bar on the base, but you couldn't get anything to drink. You know, after you fly your mission, you come in, and for interrogation, they'd give you something like 3 ounces.
Uh-huh.
And you and I could be mad as hops with each other because of the way you flew. And other than that giving you a hard time, well, after you have that 3 ounces of liquor, you got your arms around each other. And everything's all right for the next mission.
How about gambling? Was gambling a problem? Or
gambling all the time. Everybody did it to learn the money. One thing. You know.
Oh, earn some money.
No, to learn. To learn the money, you know, what a shilling was.
Yeah, learn the money. That sounds kind of hokey to me, but anyway, they did it because they wanted to pass the time and somebody wanted to make
some money. And nothing else doing. Of course, at the officer's club, they always had a game going. You could go and get in if you wanted to. Want to play pinochle, want to play bridge, want to shoot pool. Actually, when I got out, you might know that now, that I seldom ever go to the country club. I stayed in the officer's club so much until I just got enough of it. I didn't know.
Did you have any problem with AWOL?
No.
Did you have any trouble with people who just... psychologically,
had
just
some of those.
Lost it.
Had know. Some of those. Matter of fact, I flew with one of those boys after my co-pilot checked out for leave for airplane commander. And this boy was, when you get on the bomb run, he put his face in his helmet and hide. You know, he just couldn't take it. But he flew with me a few missions and went along before he came around and he was all right. But it was just on the bomb run. Any other time, he was all right. But when you were really in combat, it shook him up. And I think anybody that had any brains probably would get disturbed. It didn't bother me a whole lot. Because I had it figured out that the only way they could kill me was to hit me in the head or in the heart, you know. And that's two pretty small places.
I guess. Unless they took your plane down under you.
Well, I'll tell you what. I saw some that were just, you know, just exploded.
Sure.
And flew together and, you know, and this sort of thing. But we didn't have much of that going on. Tell you what we did one time, though. We were on a mission there one time, and somebody goofed. We flew in 36-jet formations. And we were on the bomb run, and you're not supposed to change your course at all. You hold what you got, right, because you're doing this for the bombardier, see?
Right.
I mean, you got to get things lined up. But we went through there, and here comes another 36 coming right at us. And this is the truth. Our box of bombers went through that box of bombers, and we didn't lose a plane. Nobody.
How did they?
I have no idea.
You ever talk to anybody in the other group later?
I was up front. I was flying in the number two position, and when I saw what was going on, I Shondell mine. I got the heck out of the way. You know, I didn't let that group bothered.
You didn't try and fly through.
No, I didn't try to go through, but the rest of them went through there and high in the wheel, they did it. I don't know, but
that is amazing.
They went ahead and got rid of the bombs.
How much space is there between for them to fly through? I mean, what's the distance between the ships? Vertically, you know, what, 100 feet or 200 feet?
Well, no, we were the same altitude.
I know, but in order to fly through, obviously you had to have some space.
Had space between them.
So what was the space, would you figure?
Oh, I'm going to say probably 50 feet, maybe. But I tried to fly mine.
Well, you had no margin for error, though.
No.
You had to do it right.
And so I used to fly mine right into the slot, right behind the wing. I'd hang mine in the waist if it could. And then you don't get fighters to come through you. But how in the world we got through that group, I don't know.
That is amazing.
And another time, our lead plane lost an engine. We were on the bomb run. And we couldn't continue like we were, you know, because the group behind us was going to overrun us. So we swung out, S'd out a little bit, and the group behind us came in front of us. And when they hit the target, the fighters hit them. I would have been in that group that the fighters hit if we hadn't lost that
yeah.
engine on that.
Right.
And when we got through, why in the world? After you unloaded the bomb, I think, because I remember that the lead pilot flew on in on three engines. It'd do it. I don't remember anything except that the way they came in down there was something else. The fighters, they had us picked the next group that was coming over the target, you know, they were going to get them. And it just happened so that the other group got it instead of us.
Did you have any, were the P-51s able to accompany you most of the way to the target?
P-47s, the latter part of the war, they had bases on the continent. They moved over the continent and they didn't have Spartan fly. But
yeah.
While they were back over in England, they'd have to let you go by the time you got to the Rhine River. You know.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side one. The interview continues on tape A, side two.
Russians, front line support.
Yeah.
No kidding.
We went to all the way over there by George.
You had what 1,500, 2,000 miles over there? I don't know.
It was a good long ways, and of course you cut down on the amount of your bomb load so you can carry more gasoline to you.
Yeah, right.
They had that thing figured out pretty good, and whoever did this, they had it so I bet we didn't have 15 minutes. Flying time left in the plane when we got back home.
Really calculated down to the.
That's what you're doing is trying to get as much bomb load over there as you can. And you come home safely. Two objectives.
They can't miscalculate that ratio between bomb load and gas.
That's right.
Charlie, did you notice any discrimination of any kind while you were over there? Whether it be by other services, maybe even whether our allies, or racial discrimination of any kind that you noticed?
Well, see, we basically didn't have any blacks on our base while we were over there. And I don't think we had many while we were over here. They were all segregated, you know. They had black divisions and they had the white divisions. And if I remember correctly, I think I remember them saying that they didn't have but maybe a handful of black pilots, not many, if any. I can't remember, but that was really back in the segregation days.
Yeah, right. It was even segregated in wartime. In wartime, it was still segregated.
Yeah, even in combat.
You talk about spare time in the officers' club. What was a typical day like when you had a mission? I mean, you were gone, 10 hours, 12 hours? Or?
We were usually back home.
If you took off at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock, whatever.
Well, right about 4, 5, 6 o'clock, you know, depending on how far you're going.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And most of the time, we would assemble and it was light. You know, you could see where you were going and see the other planes. And we already had an altitude. You had to be, see, the only thing was so planned, you read it off of the map, see. You do what you're told to do. And if you're going to assemble at one place, you got to be a certain altitude at this place so you can fly into your assembly point, you know, at the right thing. It was...
And typically, a typical mission might last from when to when, you know,
Six, 8 hours,
yeah. So you got 3 hours going and 3 hours coming, basically, or four or whatever? And then 15 minutes over the, or 10 minutes over the...
Over the target.
Oh, not even that much. It's just probably 5 minutes over the
target.
Yeah,
but you see, you got to pass over so many other targets that, on the way into your mission.
Yeah. And
if you go into Berlin or Chemnitz or in Swinemunde was another long one. It was way the heck off over there on the North Sea. Dresden was a good long one.
Yeah. So, was he one of the 8 hour type or more?
I won't say it must have been about seven.
Uh-huh.
You know, I hit Dresden, which was one of the turning points of the war.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
According to the book that I've got in there, we killed 135,000 people on one mission.
Civilians?
Civilians.
All civilians, right?
So whoever was working in the factories.
Yeah. Oh, you hit the factories. So
wait, yeah.
You lambasted them.
Really got them.
What did they make there? Do you happen to know what that...
I think it's ball bearing that.
Did they tell you before you took off what type, you know, what your object that you were supposed to destroy made or what it did or whatever? Did you know? We were talking about your normal day. Now, you got up at what, 3 or 4 o'clock, whatever, you took off at 5, 6, probably got back from your mission around 2 or so, I suppose, 1 or 2 in the afternoon, you know. 6-8 hours or whatever. And then what did you do? What's the first thing you did when you got back? You landed your plane, what did you do?
Well, we go into interrogation. And you go over what happened and what you saw and what you did. And by that time, they've got your films already processed, you know, and they can tell you what kind of hits you got.
Now, what films did you take? From what place on the plane?
Opposition. Well, number 2 position most of the time.
Is that co-pilot?
No, number 2 position. You got a lead plane, and then you got 2 planes flying off of the lead plane.
Okay, all right. Number 2 position. And how many cameras you have on board then? How many cameras would you have on board, approximately?
Well, every group had one.
Did you have one on your plane?
A lot of times, yeah.
Uh-huh. And you had a camera or several?
Just a camera.
A camera. And where was it pointed?
Most of the time...
Straight down or what?
Most of the time, if you owned a bomb run, they had things going pretty good there. You had any fighter opposition in the flak, heavy stuff like this, you know. They took pictures of this because this is always advantageous.
Well, who was the camera? Who was the cameraman?
Oh, you had a special cameraman.
Oh, okay. So you had a cameraman aboard. Yeah. Okay. So he was an extra crew member then at that time.
Extra, yeah.
Now, was that a portable camera?
He'd go. Yeah.
So he'd go wherever he needed to go.
And so that's all he was doing.
And if you're on a bomb run, would he actually take
a shot to the head.
Right down over the hips? Huh? Okay, I got you. And there were several planes in each group that had a camera, or just
one to the group. One. Yeah, we see you fly 36 ship groups.
Yeah.
And each one of them had somebody, and I think they would vary the positions in the formation, you know, to where they. Mm-hmm. Plane would mean the camera would be.
Okay, so you got back then, you went through interrogation, they looked at your films, and what did they do with the films? Did they show them to you?
No. What did they tell us about them? You didn't see them.
You didn't see them.
Didn't see them. But they talk about, I know one time we had an old boy down there that I checked him out. He was a B-24 pilot, and I thought he was a B-17 pilot. I go in, I got between the seats, and I'm just going to ride along, because these boys, the only thing I'm going to do is help them out with the procedures in combat, you know, where to go and what to do and that thing. And so, and they, most of the time they hadn't flown in it for 2 weeks, you know, from the time they left the States to the time of three, the time they got over there.
Is that enough time to get rusty?
Oh, well, you get a little stale, just like you do watching the ball, you know. You kind of need to get refreshed and a little confidence. So I get in, and I got between the seats, and he gets in the pilot seat, and the co-pilot got in his place. I'm standing in between them. I said, okay. Read the checklist, you know, for start and position and everything. You know, everybody's already been through this, and you know what, and you're going to do it. So they went through all the procedures, and when he got ready to taxi it out, did a pretty good job, got on the runway and gave it the throttle and it's off and running. And we got down there, and the clown used some brakes on takeoff. And I said, I wouldn't do that. I said, we don't need all that runway, something like that, you know. Went on, flew the mission. The pattern of what went through the procedures, you know, what you had to do. And I said, okay, let's go home. Where's home? And he showed me. He took me home, took me in there, flew the pattern. Standard pattern, you know, just like everybody else did. Came in and landed. He got on the brakes on the landing and rocked the tail wheel up off it. Again, a little bit. I told him, I said, well, by Jordan, that's one thing that you might do better than that. I said, no excuse for that. He said, well, I said, that's sort of the way we've been doing it, you know. I said, well, that ain't the way to do it. And went on in and I'm filling out the forms. Jim Stewart says to me, said, how'd they do? I said, he's ready. He's taking over. You what? He's ready. And he said, you don't mean that. I said, yes, I do. I said, I fly off his wing. He said, He said, this is the first time he's ever been in a B-17. He says, he's been flying B-24s all the time, and he got his orders kind of mixed up, and he got them shipped up over here, and we're just going to see if we can use him. Won't you check him out? I said, well, you take him up and check him out. I said, he's ready for it. He said, push me a form up over there. So help me, the first mission that he flew, his name was Dunn from down at Montgomery, Alabama. And when he came in after his first mission, they put everybody when they first started on Taylor and Charlie. And we got shot up pretty good. And he had sense enough to know when he was cold back there. You know, some of the planes get shot up and get out of position they falling out, getting out there so a fighter could pick him off, you know, that sort of thing. Only thing old Dunn was keep pushing the throttle. And when he got through there, I think he was flying in, the lead element. Came in, they were writing him up. And I tell you, I don't know who he was, but says, I want to fly off his wing. He said, tell you what, said, he won't get you back off and lose you. And he wouldn't either. Nice fella. But he took him in there. And, did you try one of these?
No, I haven't.
They're new ones.
Okay, tell me, let's continue on, Charlie, what we were talking about. Now, you got back and you did your interrogation. They did the films. What did you do then? What were your requirements? And were you off at that point or until your next mission, or did you have to go do any training? Or
the only thing we had to do was stay within range in case they needed us. You know, sometimes that somebody would get sick or have some problems or something, you know, and they need an extra man or need somebody. We had to stay around. They didn't have us over there for the fun of it. They had us over there to keep 36 planes in the air every day.
But once you got back from your mission and went through your debriefing and so forth, then you were free the rest, basically free the rest of the day. And then... Then until such time as you had another mission the next morning, then you had to go through the briefing and so forth for that mission.
Sometimes they scheduled you 2 days in a row, but it wasn't often. Most time you'd have 2 or 3 days in between.
Oh, I see.
So, they give you a chance to get over the fatigue of the first one.
Mental fatigue, my gosh, it'd just be terrible.
Well, like I said, somebody did a right good job of training me. I didn't have sense enough to really worry and have sleepless nights. And
there were some who did, though, obviously.
Yeah,
there were some who did. Did the Red Cross or the USO or anybody, those types of organizations, do anything for your men or for the officers or whatever, any entertainment or extra little attention that you might have gotten through those organizations?
I don't know whether they did anything for us or not. They did for the enlisted men. For the enlisted personnel, they had groups in the towns nearby around there, mm-hmm. where they had entertainers and girls, and where they'd bring the girls over on the base and have dances and parties and things, mm-hmm. you know, and sort of a...
So they got some attention through that direction, huh?
That's right, and... Of course, I had that job sometimes taking the girls home. You know, we'd take them home in trucks and vans and things like that. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, they'd have about two or three chaperones, you know, to see that they got home back all right. And we were doing this for the Red Cross, and they had Red Cross on the base down there. So I imagine the Red Cross, where we picked them up, you know, and where we delivered them. It was pretty well organized, you know. I think it was good for both groups.
Good for morale. I mean, there was
for the people who live there as well as the ones that are going to base.
Yeah.
It don't hurt a thing for to have a little relaxation, and I don't know if that it was all clean above board. They might have had some slip outs and they on both sides, you know, they get away with it. They weren't that strict on them, but it was pretty well supervised. Matter of fact, I was always amazed at how well everything was managed
in a chaotic condition of trying to fight a war.
How in the world, somebody had to do one heck of a job in organizing.
Absolutely.
Here it is, you got a group of people down there that are looking after all the food supplies. You're looking after all the clothing supplies, the ordnance. You've got somebody looking after all the gasoline. Somebody's looking after all these other things. And it's got to be coordinated. It's all got to come together somewhere. And they got to know how much of what they've got and where they can use it. How on earth could they meet with the ground forces and let the ground forces tell you what they need done? Say they got a thorn in their side off over there, some group of Germans that's taking over an area down there, and they're building up, and then we got to have something that maybe they're building a railroad yard through there. Or maybe they're just building highways or bridges or something so they can get to an area. This has got to go through the chain of command somewhere so that they've got to decide what's got to be done, what they need to do the job with, and who's going to do it, and how we're going to supply this group. And I don't see how in the world they could do it as fast as they could.
It's amazing. It truly is.
And at the same time, if you're going to advance a group of troops, you've got to advance enough food to go along with them, ammunition and the whole thing.
Absolutely.
I tell you what, if the government was run like the military, it'd be one heck of a lot better place.
That's very true. One of the questions I asked to ask you is, how well did you and your fellow service members get along with civilians while in the U.S.? Any particular problem there?
Mm-mm.
I mean, I wouldn't think so. Mm-mm. How about overseas? Any particular?
No, sir. We were classified as being their helpers when we were over there. We saved their lives, you know.
Yeah, they appreciated it.
They appreciated it. They showed their appreciation. And in the country here, I even had a truck driver one time pick me up while I was hitchhiking in Texas. And took me in and bought me one of the Texas breakfasts. It was steak and eggs for breakfast. Man, it was a feast. I bet that meal cost him $3 back in those days.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
And I was gonna pay for mine. He didn't know, sir. So I'm making more money than you. I'm driving this truck. They wouldn't take me. He said, I can help you.
That was typical of what your experience was.
Some of them. And I met the head man for the Lions Club in St. Louis one time. We were in the line going through to get a buffet, and he and his wife were right behind me. And he did like you would expect now for most of the intelligent people to do, was to pick a conversation. So we got to talking, and I found out that he was head of the Lions organization in the United States, and he was going from. He said he didn't get a chance to travel much. But at this time that they got transportation for he and his wife to come down to St. Louis, and I told my daddy about it. He said, "Yeah." I said his name was in the publications down there. So I did get to meet some nice people too.
How would you characterize the overall health of your unit? Were people in pretty good shape, physically, mentally, for the most part? Would you say?
Super.
Was medical care adequate?
Medical care was good. I didn't have any problems.
Okay.
I don't guess anybody else did. I don't remember.
Charlie, what did you know about the general war situation before you went in the service? Were you like most everybody, just what you read?
Like most everybody, just whatever you read, whatever you did. But I got to be what I felt like pretty well informed.
At what point?
After I get my crew.
Yeah. Okay.
I had a nose gunner that washed out of the cadets. Mm-hmm. That before he went in the cadets and washed out, he had gotten to be a master sergeant in the cavalry, a master sergeant in the medics, and a master sergeant in the artillery. Now here he is, had master sergeants in three areas. He goes to cadets, and they bust him out because he came out with that 36 hours, you know, they didn't need anymore. And so here he is in my group, and I'm going to say truthfully, I don't believe that there was a man at any base that I was on that knew as much about military procedures and what to expect and what was happening than he did. I'll say this, I think if our plane had gotten shot down and had to bail out, I think every one of our parachutes would have tried to get around him. He understood military procedures. He'd go in at night. He kept a pegboard, a little pin pegboard, all the divisions and how many troops they had and this sort of thing, you know, on the ground forces. He was betting 6 months before the war was over that he could come within a week of the time the war would be over. He had patterned them down. It was interesting as it could be to see our groups throw out a pincer here and a pincer here. They do what they had to do here. Our forces, we were hitting marshaling yards, railroad yards, bridges, power plants, everything all throughout this area around it, see. Mm-hmm. Germans had their troops in here. They're building up. Leave them room enough so they could come in, supply this. We had intelligence. They'd come in and get things ready. We'd come up and we'd close those pincers on the back, wall them in, then wait about 2 weeks till their supplies and ammunition and everything was down. We cut off their supplies on the backside. If they had little railroads come through there, we'd cut the bridges or we'd get it so that they couldn't get across to resupply their forces.
Right.
And we'd let them sit there for a little while. Here we are sitting over here, you know, these pincers out over here and everything cut in the back. And after a while, they'd close in on them and bring them down. And he had the divisions. He knew his military. He knew exactly where everyone was located, and he'd watch to see where they made their move. You know, this had come out in the papers, you know, about where the forces were building them, what was happening there, and mm-hmm. had opposition. He was real interesting. Married a girl in El Paso, and she what a wedding gift. Her parents gave him a section of land, which was 640 acres.
Oh, really?
And she was the organist in the church, and he was one heck of a nice fellow. They had a baby after he was in service. And I don't know whether it was time away from him or what, but anyway, he sort of goes berserk. And he got to be Master Sergeant I could be 84. But he stayed back over there in the ground forces and got to be Master Sergeant in the maintenance division.
Unreal.
But he was doing well. Well, this other boy that was only the he was a tail down. Tried to keep up with all the group. And he said the last he heard from him was in he was in Albuquerque. And he said he was right at the end of it. He lost his wife, lost everything he had. I think he said he married again and she left him, and I don't know, hit in the bottle.
Yeah, oh boy.
And so we never found out what happened to Hussein, but.
from a daily standpoint, how, you know, your friend obviously kept up to date. Were you supplied with information other than the newspaper about what was happening with our troops in Europe as they advanced and so forth? Were you pretty well kept up to date on that, Charlie?
We kept pretty well up on it because...
through the military communication.
That's right. Yeah, when we go through for briefing, they had this map on the wall and they had everything on the wall.
So you could tell where the troops were and everything.
Where the troops were and everything, and theirs too. The whole thing, and a lot of times we knew when we were coming over opposition. And by George, they'd let you know on the ground when you got there too.
How's that?
They shoot at you, man. They unload those.
Oh, okay.
Send that flag up there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I see what you mean. I was thinking, yeah, okay. So obviously you had a lot of flak flying your direction whenever you...
Oh, well, a lot of times you'd get up there and walk on it as far as... How much was out there? But see, the thing that made it so bad, it wasn't as bad as it looked. Because it takes 5 minutes for one of those things to dissipate. You know, a bomb after it's done its damage,
The
smoke is still there, the black smoke is still there.
Oh, okay. Okay. So the bomb fragments, the harmful part is gone.
All gone, but you still got
it. But you're flying through, and of course scares the crap out of you flying through all that stuff. Yeah, I'm sure you were. From your standpoint, of course, you were in the air. Were you in a position to judge, or do you have any impression about the enemy's tactics and weapons and how well organized, led, and supported they were, and just the general opinion of the people you were fighting? Just your overall impression.
Overall impression was that the biggest trouble they had was in their high commands. You know, when the greedy ones wanted to starve. You know, they'd say, let's do this instead of the other, you know.
Well, Hitler himself was preserved.
Yeah. But I believe, as far as their organization was concerned, the people who were doing the jobs, I think they were doing super jobs.
The military organization itself was, you thought was good. How about fighter tactics and those kinds of things? Do you think they had any weaknesses or particular strengths in the way they did things in the air? Or was it the same way we did things?
Well, they just didn't have the equipment or the training either. They didn't. Our group did a pretty good job. We did a pretty good job. We weren't second class citizens. We were out front. We had the advantage all the way around.
Did you notice as things kind of wound down? The war started to wind down, and you toward the conclusion of the war. Did you notice any difference in what you felt might have been shortage of supplies or aircraft or those kinds of things? Did you tell a difference?
For them, yeah.
Yeah, I'm talking about that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We didn't have any fighter opposition at all. They didn't have any fuel. They didn't have any planes. They didn't have any pilots.
At what point was that in the process? Do you recall when that occurred? Or was
that occurred...
Was it a particular point that you could kind of point to? Or?
I'm going to say I hit Dresden, like I said, on Valentine's Day in 45. And I think from that time on, we didn't have any opposition
to speak of.
It was real.
Talking about fighter aircraft opposition.
Well, we didn't have any fighter aircraft after that.
How about the flak and the?
We had some flak and but the people who were firing the guns, they said were women.
Or kids probably.
Yeah. Now, matter of fact, on my last mission, somebody shot at me on Jersey Island over there just one time. Boom. I'm out there on Jersey Island, and that's in the middle of the channel, you know.
Could you tell a difference in the accuracy and so forth later on? I mean, were you in a position really to tell that?
Yeah.
I mean, the flak was exploding well away from you.
They had reasons for it, one of them, and they hadn't compensated for it. We were throwing out chaff. And chaff is nothing in the world but little strips of aluminum at about 3/16 inch, I guess.
Yeah.
It's not a quarter. It's a little smaller than a quarter inch strip.
Yeah.
And they come in balls like hay. And what you do, at the given time, our people were smart. I didn't have anything to do with it. They checked the windage. They knew where the wind was. I think the navigators might have been able to do it by their headings, you know, what they were doing. And maybe beforehand, maybe they were getting somebody to send information. I don't know where it all came from. But it was well organized anyway, and we'd throw this out at the given time so that it would drift away from where we were going, so that the artillery would fire into the flak instead of into the planes. Mm-hmm. So of course see, you put 36 planes out there throwing that stuff out.
Now, they were using radar, I assume, and aiming using radar, and they were picking up the chaff instead of the aircraft.
That's right. And,
How long did you use this procedure?
Chaff.
Yeah. All the time you were flying, or was it picked up time?
I think most of the time. Most of the time.
This is something that was well used throughout the war, basically. What'd you say?
Because it's they couldn't see us. You put a plane up at 33,000 or 34,000 feet, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, a lot of times at that altitude, we were leaving a lot of contrails.
Mm-hmm.
and they could see that, but by the time you put on a maximum effort in Berlin, I was on one. We had 3,000 planes in there. Now, when you've got that many up there dropping chaff and just being at them, saying, how in the world are they going to pick out a target? So what they did, basically, I think, was just pattern bomb, you know, and blast at what they thought was the right, because we'd see them throwing flak up over where our chaff was. Mm-hmm. And we also saw a rug coming where we were too. They had a lot of ammunition.
Now, were you primarily high-level bombing or low-level?
High-level.
Did you do any low-level, or any of your other squadrons that you were involved with doing any low-level?
I hit one at 6,500 feet down in, and I enjoyed that one. That was down in, right on the border of Portugal and Spain. Down there, we're right on the coast. Rodeuse was the name of the Rockford area. Rodeuse. Anyway, they had some Germans that were living down there in those castles in the mountains, mm-hmm. and they were harassing the local people. And they asked us if we'd come down there and hit that target. Well, we went down to hit it at 6,000 feet, 6,500 feet. And while we were there dropping our bombs, looked out over in the sea, and there these battle wagons were shooting it sideways. They weren't shooting straight toward the ship, they were shooting sideways. And when they fired those 12-inch shells, you see that whole boat
move.
They move, yeah, that's
I believe,
right.
Yeah.
I didn't get to see much of the war like that, you know, but that's, I got to see that one time. And I got to see, I was just before crossing the Rhine coming home one time, and had to lose altitude for some reason. But anyway, I got down pretty low. And I saw a tank battle. Ooh. That was interesting, you know, just to see the way they were behaving. And, you know, I couldn't have been there 3 minutes, you know, when we went over, just had to be looking at it. Yeah, but, I would like to have seen more of that type of procedures.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side 2. The interview continues on tape B, side 1.
Just a typical mission. Now, what you did from the time that you got up when you had a mission that day, what you did until you got back. You've already talked about what you did after you got back. So what, describe.
Well,
the mission part.
We get up and go down for breakfast.
And this is at like 3 o'clock or whatever.
Yeah, and then we move on over to the briefing room, and that was always kind of quiet. You come in and they had a screen over the
like in the movies, I guess.
Yeah, you don't know where you're going until after the man in charge comes in and goes over it for you, you know. And when he pulls the curtain, everybody's watching. See where that target is.
Yeah, right.
And then it was a lot of grunts and groans. And
there's an audible response.
Audible response. Oh, no. Well, that's not a bad one, you know.
Yeah.
We've been there before, you know. So we had good days and bad days. We go in there and they'll tell you what you could expect on the way, how much fighters and how much artillery and how much fighter support we had. And,
When your spider support would leave you, would they tell you that too?
Yeah, they'll tell you how long they're going to be with you. And, we didn't need much of it. I don't think they cared much what happened to you after you dropped your bombs. You get home best way you can. But, we came on in we checked everything routinely and everybody on regular intervals on the plane.
So you walked around your plane and made sure it was in tip-top shape?
Tip-top shape, and only one time while I was down there did my boys fail to have the guns in it, mounted.
Oh.
And what they did was, it was cold and bleak and bad and rain and something was all the time. And why should all of them go down there and do it when one could do the whole job in the period of time they were down there? Well, they'd go in and they did this, and they got mixed up on whose day it was to put in the planes. And I got down there and there wasn't a gun in place. There they were in there sitting in the shack and their side stove getting warm, and there the guns were lying out there.
Jeez.
So that last time that happened.
What happened that time? I mean, you.
Oh, I just had sang my song and then they got.
Did you get the guns aboard? Okay.
Oh yeah.
And you wouldn't fly without them
in there. Yeah, everybody puts his own in right now.
Yeah.
And so they got that. I didn't care who's doing it, but just, and of course
get it done.
They knew they were riding too. They were much a part of it as I was. Yeah,
absolutely.
That was something that you can expect to happen, get careless after a period of time. But anyway, then we went ahead and got on the plane, and they had fired a few rounds, to get the guns operating in good shape after they get in the air. And
is usually over the channel, or when would that
most
be
of the time, yeah, we could get out of the way. And we had routine check on everybody at every station, all the way around, and is everything working good? How you doing? And I believe this was the co-pilot primary responsibility to see that they all got checked out, what they were doing, where they were going. We could talk on intercom pretty good inside the plane, but when we use the radios for outside contact, that was sort of all had to be coded. And
How was it coded?
Well, like my co-pilot was Little Boy Blue.
Okay.
And he was a singer. And they'd come, somebody come on, Little Boy Blue, come blow your horn. And then he'd sing a song for him or something. And then occasionally something would happen, like the last meeting I went to, they had this old boy on there that we were right over the main highway through Germany there. Autobahn.
Yeah.
Right over the Autobahn. He was, you see, drop one bomb, drop another bomb, and another bomb, until they got rid of all of them. And I think it must have been 100 pounds, because they just kept right on dropping.
Now, why was this being done?
Dropping bombs. As he opened his bomb bay door,
yeah,
dropped his bomb right at the door.
This is without authority, I take it.
Yeah. Why did he do it? The weather got kind of bad, or somebody didn't do their job right or something. But one of the top bombs in Iraq had come loose. Now that bomb is resting down on the others.
Armed?
It was armed, yeah. Ready to go. So what he's got to do, he opened his bomb bay door and dropped one at a time out that thing. And I said, somebody just hit the intervalometer down in the bomb bay room, you know, and was dropping them one at a time. Because of the space, it's about like that. He said, man, he says, I want you to know, he said, when we let that last one go. And he got through that, said, that was the happiest time you ever saw.
Now, what could have happened is if he hit any kind of a bump or whatever.
The whole thing would have exploded.
You could have set that bomb off. Oh, boy. So now you found out why he was dropping his bombs.
I was wondering that. And this was at the last meeting we went to. That
was this your last, like your last mission you talking about?
No, this is the last reunion we had.
Which
was last year. So
you heard the story then?
Yeah, okay. I heard the story. He was telling about it. I said, what? I said, I never knew what. I said, I just knew good and well somebody had goofed.
Yeah.
And was reading those bombs were coming out because I was behind him in the formation.
Yeah. So he had an armed bomb that was ready to explode.
That's
if he hit a air bump or whatever, huh?
Yeah, well, if it hit something hard enough to set it off, and he was afraid that the whole thing would jam when he released them. See,
yeah.
So he set it so he could release one at a time.
Yeah.
And there he was, he said, man, he said, that's the biggest hole you ever saw, looking down through that bomb bay with that thing wide open. But he said that wasn't as exciting as trying to get those things out of there.
So anyway, continue with your flight.
Checked
out every station.
Checked out every station, and we kept things going. And we all knew when we got to the IP, which was the...
What's IP mean?
IP is the initial point of the bomb run. That's where you... You turn on that, and you don't move from there until you drop your bomb. Then when you go in and the lead bomber drops his, and everybody else just trips his.
Now, typically, in the early part...
Everybody's separate.
Of your tour of duty over there, at the time you hit your IP, you've already hit some fighters and flak and the rest of it.
They're trying to keep you off the target.
You've been through all that already.
Yeah. When from the IP to the target is...
And that's the worst part, I guess, when
you
actually hit the target.
After you leave the target, they don't care anything about you then.
Yeah. Okay, so the IP, then the navigators, or excuse me, the bombardier's in charge from the time you hit that IP, I guess.
That's
right. Is that right? He flies the plane.
He flies the plane.
And he tells you what to do.
He can guide it according to his instrument down there where he wants to go.
He can actually fly the plane then with his instrument.
But he don't have a throttle or anything in that. The only thing he can do is guiding it to the target. No.
Does he relay a message to you, or
he actually controls the plane? He has control.
He controls the plane.
He controls it.
Okay, all right, good.
And he can climb or
okay. So he controls the plane from the time.
But he don't have to. You don't have a throttle.
Yeah. Okay. But he knows you're keeping that stable or steady.
Keep your airspeed.
Yeah. Okay. So the IP. How long does it take from the IP to the target usually?
Most of the time they're around, I'm going to say, 20 miles.
Okay.
Which is going to be 3 miles a minute, 5 minutes.
Uh-huh. Okay, 5 minutes, so you're flying straight and steady for 5 minutes on perfect target.
That's right, and anybody else who wants to shoot at you, do anything, you stay right where you are.
You sit and duck. Okay, then you hit,
You drop your bombs, unload.
What happens to the plane when you drop your bombs?
It jumps up about 100 feet. About 1,000 feet.
1,000 feet?
Yeah.
Why does it jump 1,000 feet? I know it's lighter.
Get all that weight off of it.
Yeah, but I understand that, but why does a plane jump 1,000 feet?
I don't know, but it goes up. It might not be 1,000 feet, but it
jumps. I'm saying it's flying straight and steady, and even though it's lighter.
Yeah, it goes up.
I guess the power of the setting you've got is maintaining an altitude, so that same power setting would cause you to jump up.
That's the reason if I drop one time, you stay in formation. And when you, right after you leave that, then after you've jumped up, what you want to do is get your nose back down.
Uh-huh.
So you build up a little airspeed. You want to get that airspeed as much as you can so you can get home as quick as you can.
And you put the pedal of the metal at that point? What do you do?
We were in formation. We did what they did, what the lead plane wanted to do.
And what do they typically do?
Typically, they build up a little speed.
And what was the, when you say build up a little speed, what was the top speed, cruising speed, and what speed did you usually fly at going back?
Usually, going back, we'd fly 160, 65, and going back and coming in 150.
Is 160, is that typical cruising speed for V-17? Or?
Thereabout, yeah.
And top speed would be what?
I'd say top speed maybe 175, I don't know.
Yeah. Of course, you'd burn a lot of oil, or excuse me, get a lot of gas. So you had, depending upon what your distance was back home and everything else, you had to factor all that into the speed that you flew and everything.
Yeah.
Because you had to maximize.
Somebody else did all this. I didn't do a thing. All I was a throttle jockey, do what everybody else does.
Did the lead pilot normally get some special instructions on that kind of thing? What speed he had to fly in order to have enough gas to get back?
Yeah, that's all built in. Somebody's done that before he gets to it.
How about if he gets shot down, who takes over then?
The deputy.
Somebody else who has that same information.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't necessarily have that, is it?
Yeah.
You would have
it? Yeah, I'd have it. And we had it on board.
Oh, okay.
So
you could compute it, is that the idea, or what? I mean, if you became the lead plane, for example, in order to maximize, say, the endurance of your plane going back, if you had to, did you have a way to calculate all that on board your aircraft?
No.
How fast you had to fly?
It was already calculated. You know, we knew how fast we would fly anyway. But see, with your nose down, you could build up a little speed anyway. And that's not a matter of taking more gasoline, you're taking less. That was already computed before you started.
Okay. So you were given all that information.
Yeah, you know how much it's going to cost you. How much it's going to cost you to climb, and you know how much it's going to cost you to come down.
That's what I was. So they gave you basically all that technical type of information before you ever took off, I guess. So you knew exactly what you had to do to get there and get back.
And they knew what you win, if it would be like winning, going, coming back.
How did they know that?
George, we had a good organization.
I know, but
everybody and everybody was a specialist in everything that he was doing.
But, you know, weather forecasting even today is not that, it's good, but.
Ours was done by radio, most of it, when I first started flying, we reported every storm that we saw and wind directions and how much it was at certain altitudes. If you get into a storm, you tell when you come into it, when you go out of it. Somebody else will tell when he comes into it. You give him position. They know how fast it's moving in what direction. It was a big deal then, according to what it is now. Now they just read it off.
That's interesting. What was the morale of your was it pretty good, would you say, generally speaking? Did you have any trouble with mail delivery and things that were kind of annoyances, you might say? How about enemy propaganda? Did you listen to Axis Sally or any of these?
Oh yeah, they were there before, but they got to be sort of fun, to listen to them.
How so?
In that how much they knew and how little they knew, and you listen to see what you have to say about operations.
Did they ever target your unit and say the 351 is going somewhere?
It seems like they have, but I don't remember.
Yeah, but they did it with some units, I guess. Yeah. Tell where you're going early.
Or what they encountered. I mean, planes they lost and that sort of thing.
How about you? I guess you've already kind of answered this, Charlie. But just in your own case, your own psychological stress as you were on a mission and so forth. How did you feel about what you were doing, and what were your concerns? What was going through your mind? Just doing your job, or did you worry, and what?
It's hard for me to imagine how I felt like I did. But the only thing that I really had in mind was killing a German. Man, it is what I did it or how I did it, or whether it was a he, she, or an it. You know, it made no difference. If it was a German, we wanted him.
Really focused.
That's right. It absolutely. They were shooting at us for keeps. And if somebody's got you out there in the field and he's shooting at you, are you going to shoot the other way? And after you've been hit a few times and really get seasoned, yeah, what you want to do is kill them. And when they told us how many people we had killed over there in Dresden, everybody just roars. Greatest thing in the world. Can you imagine, though? 135,000.
No, it's hard to believe. How about replacements coming in? Was your crew pretty stable, or did you have many replacements come in and out of your crew? Or you...
Yeah. Not because of people that I had lost that was killed or, injured on board. No, it wasn't that. Somebody else would have some trouble. Like your crew, you ended up with 7 men. 2 of them were out for some reason. They'd take 2 from my crew and put on yours to make it because I wasn't scheduled to fly. And then when it came up, my turn, it may be that some of the boys that had flown too much that were on my crew would be somewhere else, and I'd have to get some replacements from somewhere. Somebody did a pretty good job.
Did that present a problem to you, or just
no,
kind of business
no,
as usual?
No, it's a funny thing. But I never got to see any of the boys on the crew. They had a station. They stayed at their stations. And we talked to them. And we kept up. And we went out together. We partied together. I had no problems with any of them as far as things to do. But while you were on board, the job was the only thing that was considered.
Did you work with any of our allies at all ever? The British or whatever, you ever have occasion to?
No, not in line of duty. No.
You were never a prisoner of war, I take it. I would have heard about that before now, I think. Did you receive any awards or decorations?
That's at the regular citations, for the units, and I think we got an air medal for something like every 5 or 6 missions, so I got a handful of those things.
Do you hear me?
Yeah.
How about when did you come back from Europe?
I left England the day the war was over, May 9th.
Is that right? How was it that you left the day the war was over? You were already...
I had already finished my tour, and I was... I was set to come home. It just happened to be the date that the ship was leaving.
Oh, that's interesting.
So all the flags were waving, and how in the world the British got 1 million United States flags the day before. Now, somebody had made some plans about that. They didn't print them all the night before.
No, I sure did.
But you never saw like a U.S. flag on your life.
Well, what was the general feeling of yourself and the people around you? And, you know, what went through your mind that day?
That day, well, the war was over for me because I didn't have to go to combat in Japan. It was optional.
Why didn't you have to?
Because I had already completed the requirements that they...
Okay.
After you finish all that they require, and I finished the whole tour.
Yeah.
After you do that, then you're entitled to go home and do what you want to do. I don't think we could get out of service. So I could have gone into the fair command or gone in the training command or... you know,
if you had not flown your 37 or whatever,
36,
36. If you had
35 missions, I went on 37.
You went on 37. If you had not flown your required number, say you'd only flown 12 missions, would then you had to have gone to Japan?
Yeah.
And complete the rest of your missions,
unless you were disabled. A good friend of mine was disabled after about 9 or 10 missions. He was in aeronautical engineering before he went in service. They took him in the infantry and gave him a commission. And the infantry, after he left state, got a clown. Went through that and got shot down over in Italy. And when he got out of that, he was injured right good. Sent him back to Chinook Field, and he got an engineering degree from the best engineering school in the country. All paper. He was in there like an engineering service.
That's pretty good, I'd say. So you came home on May the 9th, was it?
May 9th.
And then what did you do when you got back to the U.S. then?
Well, I went back to school.
And were you out of the service at that point? You weren't discharged?
I was discharged pretty quick afterwards.
Oh, you were? So that was that was it for you then? Huh?
I was out. I was discharged way before the
BJ.
The war was over and up. In Japan.
Is that right?
Yeah. I went ahead and got out.
Did you have, you had an option to get out, or could you have stayed in if you wanted to? Or?
I could have stayed in and got out. I want to get me one of them $10,000 a year jobs that everybody had when he went in. You know, everybody that I met while I was gone, he had $10,000 a year. I didn't have one. I want to get me one of those jobs before they got them all up after they got back. So I came back and I went to work for the tobacco company down in Georgia. And I went back to school to find out what I could do. And the bursar told me, said, well, I said, what you can do there? You go to medical school or dental school or do some graduate work or something like that if you want to. See, I knew I had a GI Bill. And while I hadn't had any of those examinations, you know, you have to take for the graduate school. So I said, well, I'll just go ahead and decide what I'm going to do. I really thought about it. And then I thought about maybe going to work for Piedmont Airlines.
Yeah.
They made me an offer with that I could get one of the training planes from the military. And I could fly that on there with their airline. They'd do all the maintenance and everything and give me the ride and that sort of thing. It didn't sound like a bad thing. You know, well, they're carrying 4, 5, 6 passengers, you know. And I don't see how they, from Raleigh to Wilmington, you know, just short places around. And I went ahead and went to work with the back company. Told the name was Patterson. He was in charge of the, I think he was a bursar, whatever, was it, in charge of the records at school. And I sort of let it go with that. While I was down in Georgia, I got a letter to come to Medical College of Virginia that they had a place for me.
Hmm.
In middle school.
Yeah.
It cost me anything. I'm just going to go ahead. Well,
now it's under the GI Bill, I think.
Under the GI Bill. Yeah. So I took off up there. Never thought about going to dentistry in my life. And so he said, he put in an application for me down at Atlanta, and Atlanta took their class in its first year, in January. He said, you go down to Medical College of Virginia in September. Well, let's see, September, the market was still open in Georgia. Wrote a little letter, ashamed of it. Now, told them what a beautiful campus they had at the medical college. And when I got there, they had unloaded all my clothes, trunks, and everything out there at the medical college. And honest to goodness, that whole campus wasn't as big as half of this. And that's where they had my stuff in. I was thinking about the University of Richmond. I didn't know it when I applied. But anyway, I went ahead and had one of the fraternity boys came over and picked me up. Said, I got a place for you to stay. Said, if you won't stay there, you can stay there, but until you do, said, we'll. I'm coming in late down there, 2 or 3 days late. And
When was this day? What?
It was in 45.
45, okay. This is before the war was over, right?
Yeah. Well, right after the war was over. Because the war was over in Germany. Japan. Long about the 6th, long about the day.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was when they had the first blast. And I don't know when the war was declared officially over.
It was early September, as I recall.
I can't remember when it was. Anyway, I went on over there and joined that fraternity and stayed with them. And you know, I really didn't know that I was going to stay. I was just going to school and I was having a good time and I'd get $50 a month. You know, and the longer you stayed there, the more interested I got in them.
Stuck it.
Matter of fact, I couldn't have been in anything I'd liked any better.
Yeah, right. I know you've enjoyed your career record.
I sure did. I enjoyed it.
So you used the GI Bill paid in effect for your education? Most of it, anyway. Is that fair to say?
They paid for all of it except what I threw away.
Okay. What do you think about the Hollywood movies, TV, and so forth you've seen during, you know, about the war? Does it seem realistic to you from your perspective, what you've seen?
I don't doubt what 90% of the things that they have shown could have happened, but it didn't happen to that many people. They've glamorized it an awful lot.
Do you have other, what we've already talked about, do you have any other particularly humorous or maybe sad incidents from your time in service that you think of, other than what you've already?
Well, I lost a friend in training command, unfortunately. Two of my friends, they were flying formation in a B-17. And one of them was flying lead, the other one was flying the wing, and the lead plane turned into him too quick, and he's the boy that got killed. Turned into him.
The lead guy in the lead plane?
The lead turned too much, and you know, you don't have the brakes on the thing. You catch the power, but the only way you can stop is to go up. So he climbed up, see, and slowed the thing down. Now he's up there, and this other clown kept cutting under him. When he came back down, sort of looking for him. He was turning, but he was sort of looking for him. And when he did, his props caught the tail surface of the lead plane and cut the tail right off of that thing. And he fell. And his name was Shankle from up in your section, Indianapolis, Indiana. And the other one, who I would love to see now, the nicest fellow to be sure. He was tell you what his name is, and Peterson from San Francisco, Oakland, right? He turned out to be a bookworm after that. He just stayed in and studied and worked hard and was sharp anyway. But he roomed a couple of doors down from me.
Now, when he came down, you said he took the tail section off the one plane.
Took the tail.
What happened to his plane?
What happened to his plane? He came, he brought his one in.
All four engines?
No, it don't make a difference. You, like I said, you can fly it on one.
Yeah, but did he lose an engine or anything?
I think maybe he did. Like I don't know, but anyway, it probably what did the damage.
Yeah. But he flew it back in.
He did. They brought the plane down. They didn't have to walk. You know. Mm-hmm. Well, Jimmy Stewart, the actor, had to walk down at Harvard, New Mexico, where I went down there. Had his catapult on the wall over there. They give you a caterpillar and you have to walk. A lot of legs.
When you say you have to walk, you're talking about your...
Had to bail out.
Yeah. Oh, okay, bail out.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. He had to bail out when he was shot down one time?
No, lost the plane for some reason. I don't know what the world happened to him.
And he lost the plane, he had to bail out?
Had to bail out in the country, in the state. That's why he was at Hobbs.
Is that right? How about it?
Could have been a fire or something like that, you know.
Did you meet any well-known people or any war? Did you see any of the wartime leaders or anything in any of your exploits?
I saw Hap Arnold at the airfield, and I had on a flight suit. He had on a flight suit, and he had that little circle of stars up on his collar.
Yeah.
And I went to Wake Forest. In Wake Forest, you speak to everybody. And when I met him, hello, he said hi. Never saluted anything. The guy said, I don't.
That was your boss's boss's boss.
I mean, he was a shooting up. He was a shooting up. But he had on a flight suit.
Yeah.
And then, what was his name? The baseball player that married Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, Joe DiMaggio?
DiMaggio. He was on the same base I was on.
Oh.
And I was looking out the window that one day, and I saw a major salute him. He was enlisted now, so major salute him.
The major salute. Joe DiMaggio. That's funny. Of course, you bunked next to Jack, or near Jack Valenti. He was in the motion picture.
I was stationed with him pretty much all the way through. Yeah. He was a good friend of mine.
Huh? Yeah, Jack Valenti is one of your friends. Did you see any celebrities in the USO or any Bob Hope or anybody like that?
I wasn't there when he was there, but Clark Gable was on the same base I was on.
Oh, really?
He's a pole group.
He was
a tail gunner.
Yeah, I knew he was a crew member. He wasn't an officer.
He was a captain, but he was a tail gunner.
Oh, he was?
Yeah.
I didn't know they had captains as tail gunners.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of unusual, isn't it?
Yeah. I imagine.
You don't have officers as tail gunners. Usually the only officer is a pilot and co-pilot, right?
Pilot, co-pilot.
A bombardier, I guess.
Bombardier, navigator.
But that would be it, would it not? Are there any officers?
Yeah, I believe that's all.
But Clark Gable was a tail gunner and a captain. That's interesting.
Yeah, he left that before I got there. But like I said, Armstrong flew the first mission off of Polbrook, out of Polbrook, when they put had the base there in 43.
Uh-huh.
And he was the commanding officer at the base there. And I flew with him, I don't know how many times. I went with him to his wife's mother's on Mother Day. We took a plane up to Pittsburgh. He's from Pittsburgh, or she was from Pittsburgh. And we went up there, and he fixed us up with a command car. He drove his wife's mother's car, and we, what was it? Preco. Preco and me. We were there together. We had that car and a driver. We saw Pittsburgh.
I bet you did. Anybody else you remember seeing or associating with particularly?
I don't really think of. You know, it was sort of like a bunch of kids playing. You know, when we were in there, I thought everybody. Everywhere they were, had B-17s all over them, you know, like flies. Because everywhere I went, there was nothing there but B-17s.
Yeah, right. How would you characterize your service, Charlie? What do you feel about what you did?
I think it was a must, and I think I'm glad that I was a part of it. Happier still that I didn't have any injuries at all.
Yeah, right.
Didn't have any problems.
That's right. What do you know any percentages of the guys that went over that came back? I mean, like 75% came back, or 90%, or do you have any feel for that, or did they ever publish those kind of numbers?
I tell you, there wasn't many of them that finished a tour. I saw one old boy at the last meeting I went to, and I was asking how many of these people do you remember at the meeting, and he said, I don't know any of them. He said, I didn't get to know them. I said, how many missions did you fly? How long you were there? He said, I just flew a half of one. He went over there to the prisoner of war the rest of his time.
Oh, yeah. Okay. He wouldn't know.
Yeah, he got him on his first one.
Oh, brother. Yeah. Have you been back to any of the places that you...
I went back to Bobo.
Went back to Bobo. What's it like now, or what last time?
It was a wheat field.
Just a big old wheat field?
And we had a monument there, you know, where they... somebody had placed it down there. And interesting thing about it was the Rothschilds that were in charge of the monetary system.
Mm-hmm.
I believe she is a granddaughter. She's 90 something now. And met the lawyer and had dinner with him that made the arrangements with her for the property where the monument is off over there. And he asked her for the enough property to put the monument on and honor the people who were there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She says, all right. Says, how much do you want? He said, I said, we really don't need that much, but we'd like to have about 10 acres. We're part of the runway on it, you know, and this sort of thing. And I said, if that's what you want, said, we said, well, you want to know? Well, I said, I didn't say we wanted it. We got to find out how much it's going to cost us, you know, whether we can afford it. I said, we'd like to have what we can afford. Mm-hmm. And she says, I think you might be able to afford it all right. Said, you think 10 acres would be what you want? She said, yeah. I said, we'd be taking it after that. And I think that was a figure. And she says, all right. Said, how about the, will 999 years be long enough?
A lease.
I think it was for a dollar or something like that.
No kidding.
She said, if it hadn't have been for you people, I wouldn't have had any of it.
Yeah.
That's right. And she said, I'm just tickled to death to do it. And this is what the lawyer told me. And he's just a country lawyer down in Georgia now.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of a monument do they have over there, Charlie?
Oh, just got a stone monument, you know, with I got some pictures of it somewhere around. And got a little section of the landing strip out there that it had to be there.
Originally, you're talking about.
They had to have this spot. Because we had a hole in the end of that runway that every time you come into land, you'd have to dodge it.
So the hole was there?
The hole was there. I said, the most appropriate place they could have it.
So the hole that you had dodged is part of the monument.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And of course, they got a little fence around it. I'm going to say probably not 20 feet square.
Yeah.
But I think he got the full 10 acres, though, to do what he wants to with it. Mm-hmm. But see, the thing about this is our group is getting smaller all the time.
Oh, yeah.
We don't take in any new members.
That's right. No new members.
It's getting smaller all the time. I don't know who's going to look after that. They're trying to fix it up so it'll be maintained. And I expect this old boy probably has got it set up, you know, so that it'll be perpetuating.
Yeah, I hope so.
But I took old Gross Ghost and his
love,
wife over there to see it.
I would have loved to have seen it. I want to tell you.
Have you ever been to Dayton, Ohio?
I've been to Dayton, Ohio, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I never been to that. I think I'd have to do this.
Yeah, Dayton is a wonderful museum.
But you know, after I got out, the first thing I want to do is forget it all.
Yeah, I can believe that.
You know, well, matter of fact, I had a manual for the B-17. And I gave it to a boy here.
I think I gave you that. Didn't I give you a manual?
No, you didn't give me one of those little big ones.
Oh, no, I gave you the little, I think. Didn't I give you a little?
No, I don't remember that.
I didn't.
Editor's note. End of tape B, side one. The interview continues on tape B, side two.
Be interesting.
Yeah.
Especially since I worked with engineering over there, and I knew absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing about machinery, equipment. When I signed up to be a navigator. And the boys that signed up to be navigators and bombardiers, they made pilots out of them, I reckon. One signed up to be pilots had to be navigators and bombardiers. And they didn't see that. It seemed like it's the way it happened. So many of them that I saw that wanted to be pilots.
Yeah, sure.
And I never thought I couldn't. I don't even like to drive. You know, but I'll tell you what, I could fly that formation. And I could throw that wing tip and wait over there and hold it there. But I had enough fingers and toes to, and nervous enough to hold it in there. They didn't get away from me. And cross cockpit all the time. It always put me, looked like on the left wing, and I'd have to fly cross cockpit to get it over with. It'd be so easy, you know, to fly on this side, you know.
Oh, yeah. And look out a little easier.
But I got to look across the whole thing. I got to sit up there like this, and I wasn't big anyway. And never wore sunglasses and looked into the sun. Is that thing on too?
Yeah.
And looked into the sun all day.
Yeah.
Because in the mornings when we were going over on a mission, we were looking at the sun. Sun coming up in the east, you know, and then in the afternoon when we start home.
That's right. Looking,
looking right into the sun all day long.
Oh, I'll tell you that is.
And flying formation, and you don't look a whole lot of other places when you're doing this.
Absolutely not. It's amazing that all the pilots didn't have some kind of a eye problem.
Well, they most of them wore sunglasses and goggles and things like that. Yeah. You know, we had the flash things that you wear. And I'd love to have one of those.
So they're pretty effective, I guess. Huh?
Yeah, I'd love to have one of those now, but I didn't even wear that. I don't wear sunglasses now.
That's amazing, because it's so hard on your eyes.
But I have squinted an awful lot, and you tell that now. Jane and the children always get asked me about squinting so much.
You were used to squinting.
And I was getting so I couldn't see. That's when I was, before I had my heart problem.
Yeah.
Just in your feet.
Yeah, my feet?
You look like you're doing pretty good. But I was collecting a lot of fluid.
Oh.
And fluid was getting around my eyes. Uh-huh. And feet, and ankles were swelling, you know. And what I thought, I was just getting fat.
Yeah.
You get about the right age. And of course, you saying I was active too.
You were active.
I was active.
5 years ago, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago, whenever you stopped my time. So, but when did you stop? About 4 years ago? Three or four, whatever.
I played golf this morning.
Yeah, that's what. Who? Oh, yeah, you told me that. Yeah,
you told me that. You threw that out.
Okay, well, I guess that concludes the interview, Charlie, unless you got something else you want to add.
I won't tell you about the girls.
Okay.